everyone, and welcome to episode 31 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It's September, and that means it's time to go back to school. So I thought today we'd take a quick look at the who, what, when, where, and why of medieval education. So the first question, of course, is who got educated in the Middle Ages? And the answer to that is both boys and girls. And they got educated in different ways. And today we're going to look at formal education, so not trades and apprenticeships, but rather the formal education, the type that we think of when we think of going back to school. So, of course, most of the people who got educated in the Middle Ages were boys. And these were boys who were either given to the church to be educated, or they were boys who were noble and therefore were educated as part of their learning to become a good lord in the future. Or they were boys who were lucky enough to get an education through a schoolmaster, sometimes in a school in a town. Girls also got educated, sometimes in schools, but most often they would be educated if they were given to a convent to be raised, or if they were noble children, again, or if they were sometimes lucky enough to be put in a school with boys, but that we don't have a lot of research around that. So that's mostly speculative when we look at girls being educated in school. So that's the who of got educated. Pretty much whichever children could afford it and their parents thought it was important enough for them to do, those are the children that got formally educated. And when did they start their education? Well, as all parents will tell you and teachers will tell you, there's a sweet spot for kids to get educated, and that is after they are potty trained and before they are too old to be really obedient. Okay, that's a bit of a joke, but definitely it has to be. You can't really send them to a school environment in the way we think of sitting at desks in classrooms until they are potty trained. So that's going to be later than about 3 or 4. In medieval society, people started to go into apprenticeships or fostering around 7 or 8. So usually they were starting to be educated before that. Again, we're talking about formal education here, so people sitting and being taught from books, for example. Children were also educated, of course, at their parents' knees, being taught things like rhymes that would teach them things just as we are today. And again, they learned things about how to be helpful in the home before they were old enough to go sit at a desk. So kids were getting educated from the time they were probably about 3 or 4. They were starting to be taught how to read. Sometimes this would be at home. Sometimes this would be in a school. And we'll get more at that more later. And they would be educated for as long as was useful to them. If the end goal was to be educated in order to become a member of the clergy, they would be taught until they were well into their teens. If they wanted to be a lawyer or a doctor, or a doctor of theology, for example, then they would be educated until their late teens, early 20s. So a question that might not seem all that obvious is the question, why educate children? And I really think you can tell a lot about society by how they educate their children and the reasons why they do that. So when you think about why would you educate children? In the Middle Ages, this was to make them useful to society, but how useful? Useful in what way? And when you think about the way in which children were raised to be useful to society or to contribute to society, they were raised by the church and they were raised reading and studying theological texts. So what was the point of this? Well, if you look at medieval society, the top of the heap, of course, is the Pope. So medieval society was a very spiritual society. Christian society had the Pope at the top because the idea was to make children educated in order the end game was to save as many souls as possible. So when you think about this, it's kind of a fabulous goal. Humans being humans, you know, the execution of this goal wasn't always something that we could approve of necessarily, depending. I mean, people are people. They will do good things and they'll do bad things depending on the people involved. But people were being educated, children were being educated in theological terms so that they could save people's souls. They were educated to be clergy and help people. They were educated to be able to read their prayers, not just to administer their land holdings, for example, but to be able to access spiritual texts and to be helpful in theological terms. And I wanted to point this out because when you think about people putting their kids in school, they're putting their kids in school for a reason, right? They're putting the kids in school because they figure that's going to be a good thing for the child. And a good thing for these children then was to learn how to read so that they could access prayers and so that they could be more spiritually whole, or so that they could get a job later. But again, they were being educated via the church. So it was never a downside for medieval Christians. When you were educated in a way that would help, hopefully help you save your soul and maybe others too. So we know who got educated. We know when they got educated and we know why they got educated. So we now get to the point where we're trying to figure out what did they learn? So what did children learn? Well, one of the first things they learned was how to read. And again, this is the same for boys and for girls. They were taught how to read as one of the first things that they ever learned. And they were taught how to read in Latin, especially, because this was the language in which all of the theological texts were written, all of the natural texts were written. Everything was written in Latin. And so if you wanted to read something, you needed to read Latin. And I think there's this general idea that you only learned how to read if you went to a monastic school or a cathedral school, or if you're a noble boy who had a tutor. And that's not necessarily the case. It seems that a lot of children learned how to read from their mothers, that their mothers were some of their first teachers. Now, not every mother was going to be educated. Even the noble women may not be super educated, but many of them learned how to read so that they could read their prayer books. And especially for women, they wanted to read so that they could read other communications that would be important in order to administer their household. So we've talked about this before. Medieval women were not just passive creatures. When the men were away, and they were away quite a lot, when you think about touring their lands and administering their lands, or going off to fight, or going off to parliament, when the men were away, the women were in charge. So it was very useful for a woman to know how to read because she could read communications that were sent to her, were sent to her husband, or other things that were necessary. So women learned how to read as well as men. So both boys and girls learning how to read, and sometimes their early teachers were their mothers. And we see this in all sorts of really interesting places. One of the places that you see this a lot is in depictions of Saint Anne, who is the mother of the Virgin Mary. So in all sorts of pictures, you see Anne, she's got a book open on her lap and she's teaching Mary how to read. And there are also lots of pictures of Mary teaching Jesus how to read. And a lot of these pictures you'll find in prayer books for women. So this is kind of meta. You have a woman reading a prayer book in which there are women who are teaching children out of prayer books. But you can see that women were also involved in teaching their children how to read. Women were some of the first teachers. And I mean, and we still think of this when we think of a child's mother tongue. So they're learning how to speak from their mothers, but often learning how to read. And we want to think of this as reading as being a distinct skill from writing. Reading was a really important skill for people to access stuff, but they didn't necessarily need to learn how to write. So sometimes people who were educated learned how to read and to write. Sometimes they just learned how to read. So boys and girls were learning how to read in Latin. And when we talk about a formal education, there wasn't a curriculum that everyone was passed out and given. It wasn't standardized, but people generally tended to teach 7 subjects, and they were divided into the trivium and the quadrivium. And so if you went to a cathedral school, if you're a little boy, went to a cathedral school, or you were dedicated to a monastery, and it was kind of a very formal, more like a classroom style of education, or you had a tutor as a noble, or one of the servants in a noble house, and you were taught along with the nobility by a tutor, you would be taught the trivium and the quadrivium. So the trivium consisted of grammar, and again, this is Latin grammar, rhetoric, and logic. So this is kind of interesting, and we'll get into that in a second, but the trivium was grammar, rhetoric, and logic. The quadrivium was arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. So grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music. And again, you can learn a lot about society by looking at what they teach their children, right? We don't see history necessarily as a distinct subject here. We don't see geography as a distinct subject here. We don't see STEM technology as a distinct subject. Now, teachers back in the Middle Ages were really smart, just like teachers today are. And when you were teaching a child grammar, you could bring in history through the back door there. You could bring in literature. You could bring in ancient texts. You could bring in stuff about geography, that kind of thing, and kind of shoehorn it under the category of grammar. So that's one way that they could do that. So you'll see that literature wasn't one of the subjects that was part of the trivium or the quadrivium either. People did read for pleasure. Absolutely, absolutely they did, but not necessarily in school. And we'll get at the fact that school wasn't always a comfortable business in a second as well. But we have rhetoric as being one of the subjects that teachers were teaching in school, tutors or formal teachers. And so this was important not only because it was an important skill for people who were growing up to be clergymen or they were growing up to be nobility to be able to make a good argument, but it was also really important because most of the teaching and learning and testing of these subjects was done orally. So you needed to know how to make an argument and you needed to know how to put it together so that it was compelling. So we're going to get to education in universities in a couple of minutes, but when you did your PhD, you are creating a rhetorical argument. You are creating an argument that would be compelling enough that people would listen to it from beginning to end. And if you look at a PhD dissertation, they are quite long, and they were long exams in the Middle Ages as well. So rhetoric wasn't just important, you know, career-wise, but it was really important as part of the educational system because one of the ways that you were tested was through these oral exams. Logic was also a really important part of this as well. And I think that we kind of might put logic and rhetoric under critical thinking type skills now. But these were important to create arguments. And I think having been a teacher, being a teacher now, critical thinking, putting together a logical argument is a hugely important skill in all areas of life. And so it's interesting to see that this was part of the curriculum, if we could call it that, in the Middle Ages as well. Arithmetic, yes, we have to do our reading, writing, arithmetic. This is important because even if you were a noble, you needed to administer your land holdings. And so you needed to be able to count how much was owed to you from where and all of those things. So arithmetic, a very basic skill. It's not surprising to see that there. Geometry, this is really important at a time when people are creating stuff themselves and building things themselves. So even if you're a noble and you're never going to get your hands dirty, it's important to know the angles of some of the buildings that are being built on your land, because if something's going wrong, you want to be able to spot that. So geometry, not only is it an elegant subject and was thought of as sophisticated, but it was also really practical. Music is something that is always being cut from the curriculum these days. In the Middle Ages, music was really important, and this is why it was one of the foremost subjects that was taught. So it wasn't just music for music's sake, although there was that too. Music was also a really important part of the liturgy. So if you were being taught in a cathedral school, a monastic school, you were learning music in order to praise God in a way that was pleasing to him. So you were learning how to chant in a way that was going to be useful to the liturgy. You were learning music in a way that was meant to be part of your work as a clergyman. And music was also important because at this time, people didn't have iPods. They couldn't just play something that they'd heard on a radio because there weren't radios either. If people wanted to dance or they wanted to entertain themselves or they wanted to entertain others, music was important for that. If we think of people like minstrels, for example, their work wasn't just entertainment, but it was also telling stories and passing on culture orally. So music, vastly important. If you were a minstrel, you weren't necessarily taught those skills at school, but you were definitely taught music. Music being a critical way of passing on culture at the time. You could argue for that now as well, but this was taught formally in school because it was really necessary, not only for the liturgy, but for our culture more broadly. One of the things that might stick out to you, music as being kind of an odd subject when you only have seven, is astronomy as well. Astronomy was really, really important to people in the Middle Ages, not only because it taught you about things like time and dates, but also things like navigation, which is really important. This was important not just for sailors. When we think of navigation, we often think of sailors, but people traveling to a place they'd never been before also needed to know the stars very well so that they could tell where they were. So astronomy really important for that. It was also important culturally to tell you things about the past, the future, when it was important to administer drugs or other medical interventions. And remember that people who went through a formal education could go on to graduate school to become doctors. So this was important for them as well. We're not thinking in terms of astrology here. We're not thinking in terms of zodiac and, you know, fortune telling, but astronomy, actually understanding how the stars worked. This we could probably think of more broadly in terms of kind of natural sciences. So we talked about who learned, when they learned, what they learned, why they learned, and kind of got in through the back door on where they learned. So how did they learn? And this is kind of interesting. When I was growing up and I was learning my letters, I learned them from fridge magnets. And I think a lot of us learned fridge magnet letters too. In the Middle Ages, they had kind of a standardized way to teach people their alphabets, and that was to have it printed on a tablet. So you would have your letters, and in the early modern period, they were actually printed, but in the medieval period, they were painted on, they were inked on. And you'd have the tablet that had all of the alphabet on it for you. And usually it was covered by a piece of parchment to keep it from getting worn out. They also used books. And back a few months ago, I was speaking to Eric Crackle, and he was talking about how certain books were created in certain layouts depending on who they were meant for in terms of scholarship. So many times, a book that was created for a medieval scholar, and now we're thinking more about university scholars, the text of the actual book, the stuff they were meant to learn, was copied out in the middle of the page. And around it was a huge amount of white space. And that was so that the student could interact with the text and add notes to it that went back to some of the other things that they were learning. Maybe they wanted to interact with the text in terms of St. Jerome says this, St. Augustine says this, and they could add in their own notes to interact with this text. So the marginalia was a really important part of actually learning in the Middle Ages. And you can see books were created with this in mind. So if you're a university student, you might be asked to pick up a textbook. And this would be an expensive thing to buy because, again, back in the Middle Ages, before print, you had books that were hand copied out, and they were not the deluxe editions that you have that have gilt pages and things like that. They were, as Eric will tell you, and I really encourage you to go back and listen to his podcast on book manufacturing. They were just wrapped in another piece of parchment to just keep it all together. A nice floppy leather book that you could carry with you and write your notes in. But when you were in class, and I want to get to education and university in a second, but when you were listening to your teacher, you could be writing notes, but parchment was very, very expensive because it was made from animal skin. So how would you take your notes in a way that was as cheap as the paper that you get now? Well, you would write it on a wax tablet. So a wax tablet was about the size of a paperback book that we have now. It had two wooden boards, and they were attached usually by leather thongs as kind of hinges. And when you opened it up, there was kind of a scraped out section of wood that was filled with wax. And in that, you could just scratch in your notes with a stylus. And then when you were done that, you could just scratch off your notes. So you could copy some of the notes that you'd taken in class from your teacher. You could later copy those into your more expensive book. But for the stuff that you were learning in class, you would either memorize it there, and students in the Middle Ages were much, much better at memorizing than we are. Or you could take notes on a wax tablet. Some of the earliest books that people learned from were prayer books. And this is especially the case for women. They learned from prayer books so that they could read more prayer books later for their sake of their household, for their own sake. Some instructional books are really awesome and cool and funny. Some of them, like The White Ship, have proverbs in them for school children to learn because they had to translate them from their own language to Latin, or maybe Latin to their own language. And you'll often see these books with the other language written on top of it. So a book will be written in Latin and above it you'll see Anglo-Saxon script where a student is figuring out what it says. There are other books, instructional books for kids, that have a master speaking to a student hypothetically within the book. So a student will say, "Master, how do I know about how many angels can fit on the head of a pin?" And the master will give a long-winded answer. And this is a textbook that's meant to teach people about things. Of course, these get more sophisticated as you get older. But this is one of the ways people learn. Books for young people often had things that were hopefully eye-catching for them. So not just really, really dry stuff, but sometimes things that rhymed or would catch their attention. Because, you know, teachers back in the day were just as smart and they knew what was going to make people tune out. So if they could make it more exciting, like the proverbs in The White Ship, then they would do that. So I keep saying, let's get to university. Let's get to university because university, the system of university as we know it now, goes back to the Middle Ages. There's a lot of stuff that hasn't really changed all that much, and in a way that's really kind of awesome. So university in the Middle Ages was conceived as a place for people to learn, not for people to get a job. So when we think of it, it's kind of the way we've divided things out in the modern world, so that there is community college, which is often meant to teach you trades to help you get a job. This would be more like apprenticeship. We still have apprenticeship now, but kind of that community college towards a job was similar to the training that you'd get as an apprentice in the Middle Ages. University was meant to be something totally different. It was meant to help people learn and to make society move forward. And because in medieval Europe, moving forward meant understanding more about Christian doctrine, advancing the collective knowledge of society. This is why they learned from the scholars that were meant to be the most learned people. So Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, these are people that you learn from so that you could advance society. And so it was meant to be about learning, not about getting a job. Could you get a job with a university education? Absolutely. You would get a job as someone who worked within the church. You could get a job as someone who is an admin, or you could go to graduate school. And in graduate school, you can learn to be a higher member of the clergy, or you could learn how to be a medical doctor, or you could learn how to be a lawyer. If you wanted to study theology with the best teachers in the world, often you'd be going to Paris. If you wanted to learn law with some of the best teachers in the world, often you'd be going to Bologna. If you wanted to learn medicine from some of the best teachers in the world, you would go to Salerno. This is kind of similar to how people pick their PhDs now, in that you would go and find a scholar that you wanted to learn from. So you wouldn't necessarily say, like, I'm going to Paris and I'm going to get a well-rounded education from the University of Paris. You might say, I want to learn from Peter Abelard. I really think he's a great thinker. So I'm going to go and I'm going to learn from him. So universities weren't necessarily one big building with a bunch of classrooms. You would go to where your teacher was. Maybe they had a room and you would go and sit there and listen to them lecture. And this is how you learned. So lecture style education was university education back in the day. One of the ways in which university education hasn't changed all that much is that the university students would descend upon a town and they would take over part of that town, and they would go where rent was cheap and where they could really study, and they'd stick together. And often you have sections of town that were dedicated to students. So when you go to Paris, there is still an area called the Latin Quarter, and that was where the students were, because that's where you would go if you wanted to hear Latin spoken in the streets. You could spot a student in medieval Europe by the gowns that they wore. And so often you could see if somebody was from the town or if they were someone with a gown. So in university towns, there was often conflict between people from the town and people in the gowns, town versus gown. And this is because there were so many students that would appear in these university towns to learn that they represented a big part of the economy of the town. And so they could get together and they could make problems for the town. Beyond that, this is one of the things that is really kind of a commonality between university students back in the day and university students now, is if you went to learn from a scholar in a different city, that is probably the first time you had ever been living on your own, in your own place with other students. And so this was a time back in the day, as it is now, for lots of drinking and lots of fighting and lots of sexual dalliances. This is true now, it's true then. It's because of this freedom that you never had when you were living with your parents. So there were lots of fights between town and gown, often because, you know, the people who were living in the town thought the students were trouble and the students thought the people in the towns were stiff. This might be something that is still going on today that you can still see today. Oxford University, they say, was created because Henry didn't want the students going to Paris. So they started to learn in Oxford. But Cambridge was created out of a town versus gown fight. So Oxford became a place where the town was really, really displeased with the students. So a bunch of students and teachers went and created another university in Cambridge. So one of the ways we know about what life was like as a university student back in the day is, I mean, these are the people that were writing, right? And they left behind all sorts of written stuff, including songs about what it was like to be a student back in the day. And a lot of these songs are about drinking, about studying, about never having enough money, about being cold, and about missing home. So I'm going to give you a link to a couple of these that are on Fordham's site at the end of the podcast, so you can check those out for yourself. There is also an article on medievalist.net that's about students asking their parents for money because they don't have enough money. University is expensive. It was back in the day too. And so university education hasn't changed that much. And I actually think that is kind of a lovely thing, a commonality that we have between the present day and the students that were learning back in the day. And for all the teachers that are going back to school, I think it's important to come back to the teachers for a minute, what people thought about their teachers and how they remembered their teachers. Now, some of the people didn't remember their teachers all that fondly, and that is because in the Middle Ages, one of the parts of education that was familiar to all was spare the rod, spoil the child. And so sometimes you can tell that it is a picture of a teacher, not just because of the students that might be sitting around, but because they have birch rods in their hands. And so some of the schoolboy rhymes we have are about not wanting to get hit with a birch switch. So that's not the best memory that people have of their teachers. But other people remember their teachers very, very fondly afterwards. They will leave their teacher things in their wills or talk fondly about them. There are many, many educated men that when they're writing, talk about their teachers, how important they were to them. And so teachers, you will be remembered through history as well as being an important part of people's lives. So as you go back in, remember that you're important. And I do want to mention something that I thought was really interesting. I came across it in Nicholas Orme's book on medieval childhood, that there were women who were teaching as schoolmistresses. And we know this because that's actually become their surname in a couple of places in the 15th century. And so this is kind of an interesting thing. It wasn't just men that were going out and being paid to teach, but also women. So this is kind of an awesome little nugget just for you. So overall, looking at medieval education, I think that there is a general idea that nobody was educated, or if they were educated, they were just the nobility or just the people who were directly in a monastic school or in a monastic context. And that's not necessarily true. More people knew how to read than we think, fewer than today, but more than we think. And it's really hard to track these numbers, again, because you might learn how to read and not necessarily how to write, and that makes it difficult. But people were learning, boys and girls, and they were learning at their mother's knees. They were learning at a school. They were learning as members of a noble household with a tutor. They were learning all over the place. And of course, I'm just talking right now about a formal education and not about all the other things that people learned as they grew. So childhood in the Middle Ages wasn't just a time to be a mini adult, as people used to think, but it was a time in which to learn all sorts of things. And in terms of formal education, you'd be learning the skills that would help you to be a better person in theological terms that would give you the benefit of helping other people through what you learned at school, through what you learned from the masters whose books you were reading, from the masters at whose feet you sat. So this has just been a little bit about the who, what, when, where, and why of medieval education. And there are so many more articles on medievalist.net to look at if you want to learn more. Nicholas Orme's book is called Medieval Children, and to find the medieval student songs at Fordham University, go to sourcebooks.fordham.edu/source/medievalstudentsongs.asp. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, the big news from the last week was a huge discovery of Anglo-Norman coins. So coins from Harold, the last Anglo-Saxon king, William the first Norman king. It's about 2,500 coins that were discovered in southwestern England, and they believe the value is going to be about £5 million. So the people that discovered it and landowner are going to be well off, and hopefully a museum will be having it in the near future. So that's kind of big news in the medieval world. You can also find on our site, we have a kind of a piece on the Pensic War. So if you're involved in SCA, you know all about this, but check this out. What's it like there? And also, we have a piece on traveling by road in the Middle Ages, so which apparently was terrible. So we have that and more on the website this week for you all.
Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome.
If you missed last week's episode, you may not yet know about our brand new book club. We're partnering with Boyd Allen Brewer to bring you a new book every month that'll come in the mail and that we'll discuss together online at the end of the month. Our patrons from August got the Sutton Hoo story, and this month we'll be reading the Bayeux Tapestry, New Interpretations. You can sign up at patreon.com/medievalists. You can find all sorts of articles, including my own, about education in the Middle Ages by heading over to medievalist.net, or you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sabalski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist, and you can find my books on Amazon. You can even pre-order Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, which will come out this month in the United Kingdom. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Gee Frog. Thanks for listening, and if you're headed back to school, have a great year.